This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Thank you very much, Dave, and thank you very much to you, Dr. Kristalyn Topp, for coming to join us here, Jodrell Bank Observatory, for this live studio recording of the Jodcast.
My pleasure. Anything for an audience.
We might hold you to that later. But you are from... You're from the University of Oxford, yes, and you are, in fact, as a more interesting title, the Chief Zookeeper of Galaxy Zoo. And I want to start off with about Galaxy Zoo. Give us a quick description of Galaxy Zoo for those of you who may not know what Galaxy Zoo is.
Yes, well, Galaxy Zoo is a project that's been running for about almost 2.5 years now, unbelievably, which was originally designed to stop me from torturing PhD students.
Did it work?
Yeah, it worked very well. Because the problem we had was we had too many galaxies. In fact, we had images of 1 million of them, and we needed to sort them out according to their shape. This is something that the human eye is much better than a computer at doing. So when you had a few hundred galaxies, you got a professor to do it. When you had a few thousand galaxies, you got a student to do it. But when you get to 1 million, even students rebel.
And so you're reduced to the public at that stage.
No. Because the public are good at this. They're actually better than professional astronomers, we found, because they don't come with prejudice and they don't have any intrinsic feelings about what galaxies should be like. So we put them all on the web, asked people to go to galaxyzoo.org, and they came in their droves. We now have about 250,000 people who've classified galaxies.
Quarter of a million people?
Yep, and between them, they provided well over 125 million classifications of galaxies.
Let's go back a step and just describe what actually happens. You've got all these pictures of galaxies. Where do they come from?
They come from a robotic telescope, you see, called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. It sits in New Mexico, and it's spent about 7 years taking images and measuring the distance to galaxies. So that's the data set. And it's enormous. It's a different way of doing astronomy, because suddenly we can get enough galaxies to ask statistical questions about the universe. We can find out how many galaxies like the Milky Way there are, what percentage of galaxies have spiral arms. And all of those things tell us about the evolution of the universe to lead to what we had today. So we have these images, and what people do is go to the website and click buttons to answer questions about them. In the original Galaxy Zoo, it was just 6 buttons: spiral, elliptical, tell us which way the spiral arms are going if you can see them. Galaxy Zoo 2, that's up now, asks more detailed questions. How many spiral arms are there? Is there a bar at the centre of the galaxy, something astronomers are very keen to know about? What shape is the elliptical? All of those things. And so these are now the best understood galaxies, or at least the galaxies we have the most information about, because people have looked at each and every one of them and given us their opinion.
So what happens when people go to Galaxy Zoo, the website? They sign up, presumably.
They sign up. They get a random image of a galaxy. And you just click buttons and tell us things about the galaxy. That's what we designed the website to do. It turned out that people do a lot more than that. So we quickly grew a forum. We grew the forum because we couldn't answer 30,000 emails. So the forum is a way of, it's email zoo, if you like. It gets people to answer each other's questions instead of us having to do it. But that's become a place where people have discovered all sorts of things. And they discuss unusual objects they find, and all sorts of things have come from the forum. So the latest example that we're really excited about, a group of objects called the Galaxy Zoo Peas.
Peas?
Peas. Well, they're small, round, and green, you see.
That's a technical nomenclature that comes out of years of training to come up with
that's
these
right. Well, it was our users that named. Somebody spotted one of these things in the background of a galaxy image and posted it on the forum with the title, Give Peas a Chance. And then there's about 4 or 5, you may be familiar with the internet and the people who dwell on the internet. So there are four or five pages of puns about peas. And then it became sort of a convention in the community that you weren't really allowed to post puns unless you'd found one of these things. So people went back through and classified galaxies until they found
something. There was an incentive to...
Exactly.
That's how science gets done, isn't it? It's an incentive, a drive to discover.
Making puns is a strong incentive for both amateurs and professionals. But then they did their own digging and they found that these things had a particular spectrum, because you have the spectrum from Sloan as well. Particularly, they had a really strong signature of oxygen. What we call the O3 line, but that's associated with star formation. So they came to us and said, look, these things are small, but they're really star forming. And we were able to quantify that. They're forming stars with an efficiency that's unparalleled in the local universe. These are the sites of the most dramatic star formation. And they've been hiding in the data since the 60s. They're in catalogs from the 60s. But because no one had looked at them, they hadn't noticed how different from normal galaxies they looked.
Is the resolution of the images any different? Or
Well, there's a single pixel in Sloan, so that's why they're round, because we can't resolve them. There are three that we've got Hubble Space Telescope images of, just because they happen to be in the background of Hubble images. And there's a hint that they might be mergers. Those three have all got paired nuclei, so not just one central point, but two. It's a bit risky to conclude anything on the basis of three.
So when people are looking at these images, somebody thought, oh, that's an odd-looking single pixel? Are we talking about?
Yeah, no, it's in the background. They're quite distinctive. And the point is that the computer hadn't identified them as a galaxy. So it's not that it was in our catalogue of galaxies. It was that we gave somebody another beautiful galaxy to see. And in the background, there was this green... They look like green stars.
Hmm.
And that helps them stand out. Stars don't generally come in green.
Yeah.
Just because of the way the human eye perceives colour. We see stars as blue or white or red. But we don't see green ones. So they are quite distinctive.
The reason why these objects are green, is it because specifically they are a star-forming region?
Well, this is the interest. Yeah, it's where this... So almost all the light we get from them comes from this emission from oxygen.
Right.
And at the redshifts, at the distances that these things are... that happens to lie in what the Sloan images interpret as green. Now, if you put them at different distance, because the redshift is different, the light gets stretched by the expansion of the universe, they come out as different colours. And in fact, just last week, my colleague Stephen Bamford from the University of Nottingham has been in Chile, down on the new technology telescope, the NTT, down there, and looking for more distant peas.
So red peas?
Red peas, yeah. In fact, we label them by the band in which they're found. So astronomers call different parts of the spectrum by letters, particularly when you get into the infrared. So we found some IPs, some ZPs, and some JPs, which we're campaigning to have called PJs.
I like it.
Yeah, see, that gets a laugh. It's actually quite funny. Internet humour works. But this is fantastic. And this is, Stephen's going to kill me for talking about this publicly. We haven't published this data, so this is novel and exciting. Because these things are efficiently forming stars now. They're the sites of the most efficient star formation now. And yet we found the equivalents back at a redshift of 1. So this may be a whole extra place where lots of star formation is happening. So this is a piece of the puzzle of how our galaxy is formed that we've never seen before.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of work, and we had, I should mention, Carrie, who's a PhD student at Yale, who published the paper, and Stephen's done the follow-up, but it all came from people looking at images and noticing that there was something odd.
And that's a key thing here, because they were looking at something not just as they were, if you like, programmed to do, look at this galaxy. They went, galaxy going that way around, it's got a bar, not got a bar, what's that?
Exactly. And even if your computer could classify the main galaxies properly, even if it could look at all million galaxies and say spiral, elliptical, it's really hard to program a computer to do that and to go, what's the odd thing in the corner? That's almost impossible to automate. And so that's one of the huge advantages of this method that we're developing. You can make serendipitous discoveries again.
Yeah.
And for me, it's been the most amazing couple of years, because this is what I thought astronomers did when I was a kid, playing with my school's telescope, wanting to be a professional astronomer. Discover odd object, point as many telescopes as you can get hold of at it and work out what it is.
Yeah.
And to a large extent, that's what we're doing with the help of Galaxy Zoo, with the PEAS, with other famous objects like the Vorwerk, which we could talk about another time perhaps, and all sorts of things that the users or our volunteers, our zooites, are pointing us towards.
Is it possible that these new serendipitous discoveries that you're making has somewhat eclipsed the original goal of Galaxy Zoo? I mean, tell us about the results from Galaxy Zoo as they were. You wanted to get some information about how galaxies were presented to us, let's say, from our point of view.
Well, there are lots of... Yeah, I mean, it's not eclipsed by any means from us. It's just the better stories that somebody told jokes about peace. But no, the point is that for most galaxies... From Galaxy Zoo 1, we now know whether they appear as spiral or elliptical, and that's given us some surprises. So how people used to do this is assume that if you had a red galaxy, it was an elliptical, and if you had a blue galaxy, it's a spiral. And that sort of works because the colour tells you about star formation. So whenever you look at an optical image for astronomy, if you see blue, you're looking at stars that formed recently, stars that formed within the last few hundred million years. So, yesterday, by our standards. So that's good. So that sort of... And most star formation happens in spirals. So it's true that most blue galaxies are spiral. But it turns out if you look at the images and just judge on the shape, not the colour, you find that's not always true. We found a whole population of red spirals. And they live in a particular place in the universe. So if you think of the distribution of galaxies as being like a city, you down in the centre of Manchester, the equivalent is the centre of a galaxy cluster. And in that sort of environment, we just find ellipticals, almost entirely. And then in the middle of nowhere, out here at Jodrell, in what we call the field, you'd only find spiral galaxies. So places where there are a few galaxies, you tend to find spirals. And then the red spirals live in between, in the suburbs. So on the outskirts of galaxy clusters, almost a third of the galaxies tend to be red spirals, and almost all the spirals turn out to be red. So we've just submitted the paper that describes what we found and the properties of the red spirals. But actually, we've got a serious problem as to how these things form. How do you get a spiral galaxy that doesn't have star formation? And you start arguing that maybe the star formation has to have been switched off. So one easy way to do that is to collide the galaxy with another one, and all the gas gets thrown out or used up. But then you destroy the spiral arms as well. So you need some sort of gentle process that's dramatic enough to switch off the star formation, but not powerful enough to get rid of the spiral arms. And that's, you know, that just, we didn't even know that problem existed before galaxies do.
Yeah.
And whatever the answer is, it will tell us something about how galaxies form, and we can use that to test our understanding of the whole process.
It's quite awkward to discover that. You might think, oh, look, you've got, you know, red ellipticals in the center and nice blue spirals outside. Maybe we would expect a continuum of things from one to the other. But you're saying that, yes, they exist, but we don't really like the idea because we don't understand.
Well, the continuums, both people thought there was a continuum in star formation history. So ellipticals, no star formation at the center, spirals, lots of star formation out, and you'd have a mixture of galaxies. So you'd have fewer forming stars on the outskirts. That makes sense. But to find these red spirals, and incidentally, we also have a whole population of blue ellipticals that we're studying as well, which live out in the middle of nowhere. So they're rare. They're easier to, just as exciting, but slightly easier to understand. They're the last stragglers. So most ellipticals formed quite a long time ago. Well, at least the stars in them formed quite a long time ago. The oldest stars in the universe tend to live in elliptical galaxies. But these are the last stragglers in the middle of nowhere that have taken time to form, and they're smaller than other ellipticals, and we have a whole program looking at gas in them to try and work out what's happened to them, what's happening to their gas.
So it's exciting that you've managed to pose more problems than what you had when you started.
That's when you know you've had a good scientific idea. I was stressed. I always tell the anecdote of being stressed trying to finish my thesis, which is a process that anyone who's becoming a scientist goes through. And you go through excitement at doing anything at all, to the second year slump that was mentioned in the panto, to the third year of, but how on earth am I going to answer all these questions? And some very wise person said to me that you definitely don't want a complete thesis, because only boring theses are complete. And if you leave loopholes, then that's what you spend the rest of your career working on. So you can recognize a good scientific problem. There are people nodding behind me, so clearly other people have had this experience. But you recognize something that's worth following in science because it raises more questions. And that's why we have Galaxy Zoo 2. For example, Zoo 2, we ask about bars. So if you have a spiral galaxy, the arms can either spiral all the way into the center, or there could be a long straight feature at the center, which we call a bar, and the spiral arms join the end of it. And people have argued for years, for example, about whether our galaxy has a bar or not. So asking whether there's a bar is something we get from Zoo 2. And it turns out that red spirals tend to have more bars. So I can see everyone in the room going, why would they do it? We don't know. We're working on it. But that's an extra piece of information. And so, yes, we get new questions, but we can go and get more information about these galaxies to try and answer those questions.
Brings us on to, you mentioned earlier about merging galaxies, and that brings us on to another new extension of this work. You are getting people to look at merging galaxies.
It does. And at this point, this is going to sound so ridiculous. We're going to need to kill the Ustream because we're under embargo. So by the time this is broadcast, Jodcast people, this will be public. And I trust you lot because I can see you. So having killed Ustream this week, so that's last week for those of you listening at home, we're going to ask people to help us solve another problem we've created. So one of the things that the original Galaxy Zoo did was provide the world's largest catalogue of galaxies that are merging. These are galaxies that are colliding together. And they can be spectacular, and they're fabulous things to look at. There are some wonderful Hubble photos of colliding galaxies, and some of the 3,000 that we've got look deeply strange. So you have to think of these as like getting a still photo of a car crash, or driving past and getting one look. And you get a snapshot of the action, but what you want to know are two things. You want to know what happened to cause that, what did things look like before the crash, and you want to know what's going to happen. How's it going to end up? And we've got exactly the same thing here. So what we have to do is run a computer simulation and match that simulation to the snapshot that we've got now, and then we can run backwards into the past and forwards into the future. Works really well, except that computers are really bad at matching the computer simulation to the observations. They can get the big blobs at the center of the galaxy right, but all the detail in these beautiful long tails of stars that get drawn out of the galaxies. If you know things like the Hubble photo of the mice, or the antennae with these long streams, it's really hard to get a computer program to concentrate on those and still pay attention to the center. So this is something people are good at, and we built a fruit machine, which for those in the US, this is a slot machine. I didn't realise fruit machine didn't make any sense in America until I gave three or four of these talks.
Didn't mean an awful lot to me when I came here either. I thought, fruit machine, that's a great idea. Okay. Vending machine for fruit.
It's just like that.
It's not giving my money back.
Or any fruit.
Or any fruit.
Yeah, well, this is like that, except no fruit. So you log on to mergers.galaxyzoo.org, and you get a little, you get your target in the centre that we're trying to replicate, and then you press the button, you get 8 simulations. And you can press the button and get another 8. And you can pick the ones that are close. And then you can even take control and fine-tune a simulation. So you can replicate what we're seeing on the computer. And the simulation will run on your computer. We're only worried about gravity, so it's fairly simple. And then we can take the average. I can explain the gravity comment later if you like. Sorry, there's a joke. We've got an audience. They laughed. They need to know why.
All right.
So there's a joke that gravity's simple, right? Newton understood gravity. It's everything else in the universe that's complicated. So if you look, all my theorist colleagues think that the first 3 minutes to 300,000 years of the universe, that's straightforward. Because you've only got to worry about gravity. And then once you form stars, you've got to worry about chemistry and molecular physics and atomic physics.
This gets messy, after that.
Exactly. It's dismissively known as gastrophysics. So in this case, we can do well with just gravity and then put the gastrophysics in later. So if we get everyone to fine-tune their simulation, you don't need many people to show that this is... You don't need many people to produce the best understood galaxy merger in history. A few hundred people could do that with a little time, and then we can take an average, and then we can run a high resolution simulation plus gastrophysics of that merger. And then for each of these 3,000 mergers, we'll have a beautiful video showing what happened to begin with, what type of galaxies we started with, what happened to them as they interacted, and what's going to happen in the future. And that's going to be stunning, because then we can say what effect mergers have on the galaxy population, something we've always wanted to know.
Do you find that showing people a choice of 8 possible merge, is that enough to get a start?
Well, you have 8, and if you don't like any of them, you click the button. So the simulations run almost instantaneously. So it's not that you hit it and go away for three hours. On my laptop, all 8 will run in 2 seconds.
Oh, okay.
And on a bad laptop, 2 seconds. I need a new laptop. So you get this, you can run through hundreds very quickly, and it gets kind of addictive, and people get into it, particularly the unusual ones. We have a nice selection of ring galaxies, where we think there's been something like a head-on collision, and you formed a nice ring, but the details of that are difficult, and getting a ring galaxy is quite challenging. In fact, when we tested this, there was a whole load of data that the data looked really good, and then there was a whole load that didn't make any sense. And so we went and looked at it, and there were a group of users on the forum who decided they didn't like our target galaxy and had challenged each other to make a ring galaxy instead. So we've now provided a sandbox for people like this so that they can play around.
Go over there, just there.
Exactly. So mergers will go live on Tuesday, and Jobcast people should come and help us.
Well, absolutely.
Should we bring everyone else back in now? We should bring Ustream back. Okay, that's my confidential bit. So that was all... Are they back?
I think so.
Hello, you street people. That was fantastic, wasn't it, Nick?
Unbelievable. Will you invite me to Sweden for the Nobel Prize Award? I mean, I'm going to be there. That is fascinating stuff. And one thing I want to talk about now is, of course, your work embodies a common element, and that's people out there, the public. You've mentioned a couple of times before that you're getting people to do what computer scientists, computer programmers like myself find extremely hard to do, and that's to get a computer to do something which we as humans with a bit of gray matter between the ears find easy. Pattern recognition, being able to look at something and go, yeah, it's the same, or it's got similar features. Getting a computer to do even the most basic job like that is extraordinarily difficult. And that seems to be the common theme in getting your research done. You're getting other people to do it by using their CPU between their ears to go, yeah, those two things are roughly the same, or that's odd, that's different. Yeah,
and this is what we evolved to do, right? Pattern recognition and sorting stuff into categories. You don't notice yourself doing it, but if I showed you a photo of a cat and a picture of Tom from Tom and Jerry, all of us in the room know that that's in the same category of thing. You know, those are cats. But you try writing a computer program that you can feed a photo of an actual cat and a cartoon cat and get it to say cat out of everything else that it could have been presented with. That's the task that's really hard. Mm. Now, if the computer knew it was only going to get photos of cats and photos of Tom, it's easy to write a computer program. You can always write the specific instance. Right? You can do a really good job if you know what you're looking for and you can write something specific. Like, you know, character recognition for English works pretty well. But you can't take the same automated character recognition software and use it on Greek because it's been optimized for English. In fact, if you don't know what language you're looking at, it's going to be much better to just show it to people.
Have you ever tried using somebody else's voice recognition system on their computer, which they have trained to their voice?
Precisely.
Put someone like me on it and it goes,
Yeah. I once tried to help Patrick Moore set up a voice recognition system, but it gave up in disgust.
Blue screen of death. Ah. Well, it's fascinating stuff. And people wonder, you know, what they can do. I'll put it another way. They look at what professional astronomers do and they go, wow, you guys must be really smart. And you know, some of us are, some of us aren't. To varying degrees. What you do must be really, really hard. And you think, well, the hardest thing we can't do. We need, you know.
And the word there that's important is need. So, you know, it's easy to come up with. I love, as hopefully is obvious, I love talking about astronomy. And it's really important to me to tell everybody in the world, whether they like it or not, what we're up to. partly because I'm like that. Partly because you in the audience, both virtual and real, pay our salary and fund Jodrell. And, you know, we need to convince you that that's worth doing. But that's one level of doing things. That's me telling you what I know. But it's much more exciting to sit down with 250,000 people and find out something together. There's something really amazing about that. And we've had, on this observing run with Stephen, Stephen's been blogging and tweeting and people have been making suggestions. And, you know, it's this interaction. It's not really working with the public. We've just recruited another 250,000 scientists. And we really, really need more of that. Mm. Luckily, we've got lots of plans.
And one of those plans is your grand plan, basically, to go from a group of people who may not be, you know, even amateur astronomers, but they learn through the process of doing these exercises, is a poor word, but doing these tasks for you through the Galaxy Zoo, Zoo 2, etc., learning about what they're doing, and then finding that they're capable of making informed decisions as what to do next.
And people do their own research. But where we're going with this is I have this nightmare vision of a monster that's terrorizing me, that keeps me up at night. And the monster is called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. It's not as catchy as Godzilla, but it haunts my brain in the same way. LSST, I've already seen its mirror. It's on the way. It's an 8.4-meter mirror. So it's as big as some of the biggest telescopes today, except that it's going to work in a radically different way. It's a survey instrument. So rather than you, as an astronomer, have half a night on Keck this year, use it, take your data away, and analyze it. LSST will scan the sky continuously. It's going to cover the visible night sky from wherever it's put once every 3 nights. And that data will immediately hit the weather. Actually, whatever you know, we're going to break the net if we do that, but we'll in some way be distributed. Because the data stream we're talking about is 30 terabytes a night. So this does all sorts of things. One of the things it does is it means we're no longer talking about images, necessarily. You can have a video of the night sky, because it's going to revisit the same areas every three nights. And so if it does that, you're going to see, all right, asteroids sweeping across the solar system. It's going to map lots of the small stuff in the solar system. You're going to see variable stars moving. We're going to see supernovae going off. You're actually going to see the active nuclei in galaxies because of the light from the material around the black hole. The centers of some of the nearby galaxies will flicker because you'll actually get the change in brightness. Now, we're still estimating what this will produce. But let's say we're going to be interested in a specific problem. Let's look at what we call transients, which are variable stars, things that change. How many different alerts are we going to get per night from the LSST? So not these days, if you have one of these survey telescopes, you have an observer sitting there, or you email the team if something happens. Depending on who you talk to, LSST will produce between 10 and 100,000 such emails a night. So yes, you need computers to sort through the first set of that, but then you need to take what's left and give it to humans. And there aren't enough professional astronomers. So I think what we're going to need to do is, yes, a galaxy zoo type thing. So the first stage will be to put it through the zoo. The zoo will produce the most interesting things. But then we'll need volunteers, people like our audience here or the people listening at home, who will be capable perhaps of choosing from amongst those, logging on to a robotic telescope somewhere else in the world, taking a spectrum to classify it. Because by this stage, we're not going to care if it's a supernova. We only want to know if it's an interesting supernova. So you have to have done follow-up. And we need to make that a democratic process, because otherwise we're going to get swamped. And otherwise LSST will rampage through astronomy, and this data will get lost.
Yes.
If we don't, and these things are fast, right? If you don't follow up a supernova within a few hours, you've missed the most interesting point. So you can't put it in the archive and come back and have some poor student trawl through the archive. We need to make this collaborative. And that's the real challenge, I think, for this kind of astronomy in the next 5 years.
It's the step away from just, if you like, being as a member of the public, if you're looking at these images, classifying them, looking for something interesting, to taking a more active role and going, right, I've seen something interesting. It's curious. I don't want to be yet another email to this poor stressed out project investigator, because it's one of 10,000 that he's going to receive. But what's this thing? I will log on and to this robotic telescope and ask, well, if it's going to be something interesting, then I expect a spectrum like this.
What you do is you create a community that can do that. So some people will just be more comfortable or will want to spend their time or just classifying the images. And that's fine. We'll need lots of people to do that. Others amongst the community may be experienced amateur astronomers already, may have hung around, as has happened on Galaxy Zoo, have hung around on the site for a while and have learned a bit. We'll be able to say, oh yes, that's a P. We've seen hundreds of those. We've got a collection of them over here, so add it to the list. In that case, that's a category that didn't exist before the project started. And then some people will have the time or the energy to follow up. I mean, this is going to generate school projects by the million. But it's this idea of the community with people, to be an astronomer, to see something that no one else had seen, I had to do A-levels, go to university, do a master's, do a PhD. Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about is somebody being able to get there from nothing, from turning up on a website classifying some galaxies, beginning to talk about them, reading a bit online. And there's this career as what we call a citizen scientist, when you can develop your interest to the point where you're publishing papers. Mm. You know, and hopefully some of those people will come back and be professional astronomers. But if not, I understand people sometimes want to do other things with their life for some reason. This would give them a chance to do some real astronomy as well. And that is an amazing, amazing thing.
It's a very, meritocratic way of doing things. But as you say, I mean, if you're just happy about classifying it, then that's all that you need to do. But if you want to take it a step further, you can do it. And astronomy is one of those sciences where nobody's going to go like, oh, you haven't got a PhD.
No.
Go away until you've got one, and then you can talk to me.
And we need this to happen because we've got the data. Now, amateurs have always contributed. That's one of the attractions of astronomy. So I'm not taking away from, it sounds like I've just ignored 300 years of amateurs discovering stuff. And I'm in awe of people like Tom Bowles, who holds the UK amateur, who holds the supernova record for the most supernovae discovered with his amazing setup. Or there's a group of Belgian amateurs who have discovered extrasolar planets. for goodness sake. The idea that somebody with a small telescope in their back garden could discover a planet around another star blows me away. It's incredible. But each of those people are essentially, they don't get paid, but they're professional astronomers. There's no way, easy way into that. What you need there is 20 years of observing experience and actually a reasonable amount of money to invest in some quite decent kit. Might only be thousands, but it's still beyond the reach of the interested 12-year-old, unless they got more get more pocket money than I ever did. Mm. And so I think what we're talking about is something that anyone could do. Yeah. That's the point.
You've got around the requirement of investment in certain instances where you're in charge of the information coming in from these big telescopes. Somebody else has paid for it, given you the data, and you just said, here it is on a silver platter, if you like. Make a discovery. It's there, you know, available for people to make a discovery. Go and do it. There's nothing stopping you. If you want to learn more about it, go ahead and do it. So yes. It's one of those projects which I think is going to be absolutely fantastic. I can't wait.
For now, galaxyzoo.org, and I will be checking. I don't know how we identify Jodcast listeners, but we'll find you somehow.
Other ones are all night long going left, right.
For starters, people here, Manchester was in the top 10 of cities, and it's dropped out. So those who live locally, I expect to see a resurgence in local classification. Stuart, I will beat you up if not.
I think we'll draw it to an end here. So thank you very much indeed, Chris Lintott, for giving us a talk about what you do. And it's absolutely fascinating. So everybody, please. And at the back there, of course, is information about Galaxy Zoo. And for listeners at home, we'll have information on our website about where you can go to participate in what is quite possibly, well, for my money, the best public exercise in data analysis ever.
It's almost as exciting as the Jodcast.
Almost. Not quite.